Why Andy Murray is not the first Brit to win Wimbledon for 77 years, but first, always fascinating, US-EU trade talks.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Global Perspective on Business and Economics. If the freer trade boosters are to be believed, a new trade deal between the United States and the European Union could increase transatlantic commerce by $100 billion a year. The two trading blocs begin negotiations today after 2 years of prep. There may be an unpleasant taste as talks begin, European anger about leaks the U.S. may have systematically spied on them. The BBC's Andrew Walker is in London.
Good morning, David.
Trade talks, but they're going to be talking at some level about data privacy here.
Yes, all this stuff about what in Europe is seen as American snooping on private data of European citizens, among others. That certainly is a bit of a cloud over these negotiations. But realistically, I don't think it's going to do any major damage to the talks in the long term. German officials, for example, have said these trade talks remain the highest priority. And I think that really is the bottom line.
If these talks were to gel, what kind of tariffs might be removed between these two vast trading blocks?
Well, I think we would be looking at the reduction or removal of tariffs across a wide range of goods, for example, on textiles and clothing and agricultural goods especially. So you might see some substantial reductions there. But it's also about what are called non-tariff barriers, trying to get some sort of degree of mutual recognition of regulatory systems, safety procedures, inspection arrangements, that kind of thing. All sounds mind-numbingly boring, I have to admit. But you ask many business people, they will tell you that this really makes an enormous difference to the inconvenience and costs that they have to incur. So if you can get some sort of arrangement whereby businesses only have to do all that kind of stuff once, it could make a big difference to the costs of doing trade.
The BBC's Andrew Walker talking about that riveting subject, transatlantic trade. Andrew, thank you very much.
My pleasure, David.
Now let's do the numbers. In London, the FT 100 is up 1.2% now. The key stock index in Shanghai closed down 2.8%. Stock in the airline Asiana is down 5.75% in South Korea now after the fatal plane crash in San Francisco over the weekend. Questions about the pilot's experience in 777s. And U.S. authorities say the plane was flying too slow on final approach. The investigation is ongoing. Congress is back to work today, and that farm bill is still sitting on the to-do list. In a surprise outcome last month, the House rejected a bill similar to a version already passed by the Senate. And now, as Sarah McCammon reports, there's talk of splitting the bill in two.
For decades, the nation's farm bill has brought together members of Congress from urban districts with rural lawmakers focused on farm policy. Congressman Steve King of Iowa is a Republican member of the House Agriculture Committee. He supported the farm bill that failed in the House last month.
There's a level of codependency on each of the policy. It requires the people from the cities to support some kind of ag policy if they're going to get their nutrition piece, and vice versa.
But lately, that relationship seems to have hit a rough patch. The House bill cut more than $20 billion from nutrition programs. That was too much for many Democrats, but not enough for some Republicans. So now conservative lawmakers want to split up the two major parts of the farm bill. But advocates for both issues are saying that's not going to work. Mary Kay Thatcher is with the American Farm Bureau Federation.
So it's been a marriage that's worked quite well, and we don't want to see it split.
With the current farm bill expiring at the end of September, House negotiators have just a few weeks to work out their differences. I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
It's hurricane season, and flood insurance is on the minds of many homeowners, especially because rates are about to soar. A law goes into effect next year, eliminating FEMA's flood insurance subsidies. And the government is updating 30-year-old maps to expand areas at risk for flooding. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports.
It's open mic night at Thai Rock Bar and Restaurant in Rockaway Beach, Queens.
My restaurant is built on a pier. Robert Caskell is the owner. The deck is full of lights, but the inside of the restaurant is walled off with plasterboard, still from Superstorm Sandy.
It was horrible. Our home was destroyed, just destroyed it. We moved into my restaurant, which has an upper floor, but the whole downstairs of the restaurant was destroyed.
But there's more on Caskell's mind than renovations right now. New insurance rates.
I've heard talk about a typical house might be as much as $30,000 a year.
That's the high end, says a FEMA advisor. The new flood maps mean many more Americans will have to get flood insurance. Without subsidies, policyholders will have to pay higher rates. For many, much higher. Caskell fears his working class community will get swept away, not by the seas, but by premiums.
The insurance is going to become so expensive that the only people that will be able to live in properties like this are the wealthy.
FEMA acknowledges the changes could create hardship. It has limited funds to lessen the financial impact and says homeowners can keep premiums down by making improvements, like elevating their homes.
The challenge that we have in a dense urban environment like New York is that it's simply infeasible or just very expensive.
Seth Pinsky is president of the New York City Economic Development Corporation. He's lobbying FEMA for easier ways to reduce premiums. Some politicians elsewhere are pushing to delay the higher premiums, and that has Steve Ellis worried. He's with Taxpayers for Common Sense.
If we're not pricing it appropriately, it serves as an incentive to actually develop and locate in high-risk areas,
which could leave taxpayers footing FEMA's bill.
This is a program that is now more than $24 billion in the hole.
In the end, someone will pay for the next disaster. The question is who? In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
And another number before we go, a number we're seeing in sports headlines far and wide today. The number is 77. Andy Murray's win at Wimbledon marks 77 years since a Brit has won the tennis championship, we're told. Turns out 77 is the right number, but in the wrong context. It has not been 77 years since a Brit won Wimbledon. Turns out, fellow media, women play tennis too. Virginia Wade did it 36 years ago, back in the year, wait for it, 77. In New York, I'm David Brancaccia with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.